This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Earlier this year, we got the word from NASA that after traveling through space for nearly 35 years, the probe Voyager 1 has left our solar system and headed off into, well, we really don't know, do we? However, we are getting a better idea of what type of planets and systems are waiting beyond our solar system.
People found handfuls of planets, and they were very surprised at how different these planets were than the planets in our own solar system.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, our astrobiology series returns with a look at the search for exoplanets and perhaps the forms of life they may host. We'll also spend an academic minute in the tropics here on Earth and find out how climate change is affecting the rainforests. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Continuing advances in technology continues to improve the way we can explore and understand the universe beyond our solar system. Scientists have been using this technology to find what are called exoplanets, simply planets that are outside of the orbit of our sun. That's where Dr. Cullen Blake, assistant professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Pennsylvania, comes in. He's on the forefront of this long-distance exploration. And as he tells The Best of Our Knowledge's science reporter, David Gustina, it's an interest that began very early in life.
I think I've been interested in stars and planets since I was in elementary school. In fact, I remember learning about the solar system in third grade, and I just loved it. And I think basically since that time, this is what I wanted to do for a profession. So,
you know, when we look at the solar system, and as a young person, you look at the planets that are there, and you look at the Earth, and you look at the sun, and we see things as permanent.
Right.
That they're fixed in place, and they don't change. And if you think about that time as you were a child thinking about this and learning your basic rudimentary solar system information.
Including Pluto.
Exactly. So the point being that none of this is static, and that as we grow in our understandings, things tend to change.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, in the last decade or so, we've learned about more objects like Pluto in the outer solar system. Pluto is not alone. There are other big icy bodies that are very far from the sun with very long period orbits. So we're still learning about what's in our own solar system, which is kind of amazing.
I also imagine, Dr. Blake, that as a child, you wondered whether there were planets outside the solar system.
I did.
So now you are absolutely doing that kind of research. You're looking deep into space. You're using a number of different techniques to do this. And the technology keeps improving and keeps helping you, and you're on the forefront of this. So give us a sense. In your introduction, you say, my primary research interests relate to exoplanets, the structure and evolution of low-mass stars and brown dwarfs, and time domain astronomy. Let's take each of those.
Okay.
Exoplanets.
Exoplanets. So exciting new field. Began, you know, 20, 30 years ago. Now, in large part thanks to the NASA Kepler satellite mission, we know of thousands of exoplanets, so progress was slow initially. People found handfuls of planets, and they were very surprised at how different these planets were than the planets in our own solar system. For example, in the 90s, people were finding planets that were big like Jupiter, but were orbiting very close to their stars. They were hot Jupiters.
Were they using the wobble?
Correct. So they were finding these planets because of the gravitational pull, tug, essentially, that the planet exerts on the star. So if you observe the star, you can measure this little velocity change, acceleration, essentially, of the star. It's a very challenging measurement. It took people a long time to perfect the measurement techniques. We're getting better and better at it. And now we're approaching the regime where we can detect planets that are like Earth, a few times the mass of Earth, orbiting stars that are like the sun.
And they are rolling in exponentially as we speak, yes?
Yes, absolutely. So we're certainly in the hundreds of planets regime now. And if you look at the data from the Kepler satellite, Kepler has thousands or certainly more than 1,000 very good candidate planets that we're actively studying.
So we have exoplanets. Now, the structure and evolution of low-mass stars and brown dwarfs. Maybe you should explain the low-mass stars and brown dwarfs first, and then go to how you look at the structure and evolution.
Absolutely. So it's often said that the sun is sort of an average star. There are a lot of stars, actually, that are quite a bit smaller than the sun. In fact, about 50% of all stars are about half the mass of the sun or less. So most stars in the Milky Way galaxy are these small stars, and they're very interesting for many reasons. They evolve differently from the sun. They have extremely long lifetimes. They're small, they're cool, they're faint. Actually, they're very interesting hosts for exoplanets. So there's an intersection there looking for planets around these low-mass stars, and that's a big focus of my research.
And what are you finding out?
Well, it looks like these small stars, the most common stars in the Milky Way galaxy, have a huge number of planets. So there's some very exciting results coming out of Kepler that seem to indicate maybe 50% of these small stars have planets that are about the size of Earth, which is tremendously exciting.
Are we also talking about not only the size, but the distance from the star? In other words, that friendly zone we like to call inhabitable and possibly good for life.
Exactly. So around a given star, you can trace out a region where we think the conditions, basically how much radiation the planet receives from the star, might be such that the temperature on the planet would be similar to the temperature on Mars or Venus or Earth in our own solar system. And for these small stars, that habitable zone, as it's called, is really quite close into the star. It's because the star is faint, essentially. Those planets that are close into the star are actually a little bit easier to detect. So if you want to look for a planet the size of Earth, the mass of Earth, in this so-called habitable zone, these small stars are actually an excellent place to look.
Hmm. But there's something else that we've been learning, Dr. Blake, and that has to do with our sense of what is habitable for life. So
right.
We're finding that there are planets that would look like a charred ember, but it might be possible for something to live there.
Yeah, that's right. So our concept of what habitable really means is of course always evolving. And this simple definition we were just talking about, just related to how much radiation the planet receives from the star. So of course Venus is really hot. We wouldn't consider Venus to be habitable typically. That's because Venus has this tremendously thick CO2 atmosphere. It's a runaway greenhouse effect type situation. So that's very difficult for us to predict or quantify. If we find a planet that's in this habitable zone, it certainly might be like Venus, not so habitable.
But we have examples from our own Earth for this.
Absolutely.
When you look at the vents down at the bottom of
amazing.
The sea, right? And
really amazing.
Even some acidic lakes that they're finding that there's a bacteria that lives there.
Mm-hmm.
So the qualifications for what can be habitable and maintain life are changing.
Absolutely. It's amazing to go to Yellowstone and see these, you know, brilliantly colored bubbling cauldrons of stuff that is certainly not very hospitable for life, you would think. But yet it's teeming with life. Same thing with the underwater vents you're referring to. They're really diverse ecosystems that are totally separated from the sun. They're harsh environments, hot, toxic probably. And yet there are complex organisms living down there. It's really amazing.
It certainly is. Let's go to this other concept that I haven't actually heard stated this way, time domain astronomy. What is that?
Yeah, it's very exciting. So I think historically we have this notion that we want to map the heavens and that by and large, the things that we're observing and measuring are static on timescales that are relevant to humans anyway. Of course, the sun is evolving over billions of years. But over the lifetime of a graduate student or what have you, these things are pretty static. Turns out that this is definitely not true. That if you take a movie, for example, of the heavens, you'll find that there are many different types of interesting things that are changing on minutes or hours or days.
Such as
you can have stars that are varying how bright they are. The sun varies in brightness at a very low level. Yet we have examples of other types of stars that are having dramatic changes in how bright they are on short timescales. And we also have explosions, you know, the deaths of stars, supernova, gamma ray bursts, things like this happen on very rapid timescales. So in order to study these phenomena, you have to have a high time rate movie, essentially, of the sky.
Sure. And not to mention that as we're filming this movie, we're also moving. So,
that's
you know,
right?
I mean, we are moving through space at the same time and there's an expansion. And
mm-hmm.
much like a balloon expanding out, you can think about it like that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So basically what we have here is this idea of introducing these gigantic scales of time so that we can take a look and on a mass scale, I guess, observe mm-hmm. this movement. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct.
Great. So now let's introduce something that we've talked about before, but it bears a reintroduction, which is photometrics and mm-hmm. spectroscopic data that
yes.
you gather. Explain how that works.
Sure. So the process of photometry is measuring the brightness of a star, essentially how many photons are coming from that star to reach us here on Earth. And we want to make very precise measurements of the brightness of a star to find planets using the transit method. When a planet crosses in front of the star, from our point of view, it causes a dip in the brightness of the star. And the size of that dip tells you how big the planet is. So the Kepler satellite, the NASA Kepler mission, monitors about 100,000 stars at one time. And it measures their brightnesses with incredible precision sufficient to detect Earth going in front of a star about the size of the sun.
And as you're detecting these things and you're making these measurements, is there a team involved here? I mean, we're talking about a number of scientists that are looking at the same data, mm-hmm. proofing each other,
right.
offering theories, hypotheses, and trying to confirm them.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of the things I've liked best about this new and rapidly growing field of exoplanets. This is a great community. I've had the opportunity to get to know people working in this all over the world, actually. And we have get together and have meetings and discuss data and exciting results. So it's a really nice community. It's fun to work with people from lots of different backgrounds and places.
Oh, it has to be. I mean, when you look at the number of scientists we've had on this program and from the various fields that they've come from, you realize each scientist has a piece mm-hmm. in this larger puzzle of the origins of life.
Yes, absolutely.
Still to come, David Gustina's conversation with Dr. Cullen Blake continues with a look at what's called the Doppler effect, and they're not talking about the weather. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1206. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Dr. Cullen Blake, Assistant Professor of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Pennsylvania. They're talking about the search for so-called exoplanets as part of our astrobiology series on the origins of life. Oddly, David brings the conversation around to talking about the weather. Sort of.
You know, I often do the weather forecast for the radio station when I'm doing the morning news,
okay.
and I will occasionally mention Doppler,
uh-huh.
but we don't often think about that.
Radar.
That's right, when we're looking at space. How does Doppler come into all of this, Dr. Blake?
Yeah, so the Doppler shift enables us to measure the velocity of objects. So we observe a star. We take a spectrum of that star. That is, we disperse out the light using something like a prism. And you see, when you disperse out the light, that the spectrum of the star has little absorption features that correspond to various atoms and molecules in the star. And we can gather these spectra and look for little tiny shifts in the positions of these lines relative to where we know they should be in the laboratory here on Earth. And the size of that shift tells us the velocity of the star. That's the Doppler shift.
Whoa. So then you get the how fast is it moving?
Exactly. And if you can monitor the velocity, how fast it's moving of a star over time, and you see changes, that indicates that that star might have a planetary companion.
And composition is also part of all of this, yes?
Absolutely. By looking at the various strengths of these little absorption features in the spectrum of the star, you can learn about the chemical composition of the star, how hot it is, how big it is, how rapidly it's spinning, things like this.
Do we find that when you do look at the composition of these exoplanets,
mm-hmm.
that you're finding similar elements and chemicals that are found all over the universe?
Yeah, absolutely. So in some cases, a handful of cases, we've been able to study directly the atmospheres of exoplanets, take spectra not of the star, but of the exoplanet companion itself, and learn about the composition in a rough sense. We find evidence for things like CO and methane and even water on occasion in the atmospheres of these giant hot Jupiter planets. So we're not yet at the level where we can study the atmosphere of a distant planet like Earth, but we are able to study the atmosphere of a distant planet like Jupiter.
You know, Euripides discovered buoyancy,
mm-hmm.
and he said Eureka after he sat in the bathtub.
Right.
Do you, as a scientist, prepare yourself for the unexpected? That here you are, all focused on your exoplanets, Dr. Blake, but what happens when you make some incredible discovery you weren't counting on, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Think about that.
You hope that happens in your career. I think you have to be lucky, certainly. But as you say, you also have to be prepared to accept data that are sort of contrary to your expectation. And there are some great examples of this in exoplanets. These first planets that were found in maybe the early and mid-90s were these hot Jupiters. We had nothing like that in our solar system, so I think people were not prepared because they didn't understand how you would form a planet like that. People had a concept of how the planets in our solar system formed, and that concept did not really allow for a giant planet like Jupiter, you know, orbiting with a three-day period around its star, way close into the star.
We're talking with Dr. Cullen Blake. He is in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Pennsylvania, and it is a fascinating subject. And Dr. Blake, I certainly can't understand the math of all this. I mean, this is the reason why I'm in radio. You deal with the math. But it is amazing that when you get to science and you look at the universe and some of the things we study, that math tends to be the universal language.
Yes.
What is it about that? I mean, can you go more into that a little bit?
Yeah. So for me, I think it's really been exciting to learn, you know, as a student over the years, the sort of very close connections between math and physics. Sort of the mathematical concepts you learn in calculus class, and then you take physics class and you learn how those mathematical concepts map directly onto physical concepts in the real world. And that's been really fun as a student. And you know, I hope that's something we can teach students all the time, is this really close connection between math and the physical world.
Well, you're doing your part, right? You offer this sort of introductory course on the planets.
That's right.
And how's the reception been for that? How do you go about it in the classroom?
Oh, it's been a lot of fun. This is the first semester I've taught this class. The students are enthusiastic, great students. I think one thing that makes it particularly fun is that the students see all the time news stories related to exoplanets in particular. The New York Times has great coverage of exoplanets. Also, The Economist, for whatever reason, often has articles about exoplanets. So the students read these articles, and then we can discuss them. So I think it's evident to them that this is a rapid growth field and also a lot going on. But what's nice about planets is that they sort of have an innate understanding of what a planet is living on one. It's abstract in a certain way, but it's also like a concrete thing. They understand and have learned about the planets in our solar system since they were little, and you can extrapolate from that to another solar system. It's not such a big leap.
Well, let's go with the big leap that you just mentioned. And I think one of the things that hinders scientists, and all of us, quite frankly, for understanding in a very general way what is going on here, is that we cannot get outside of our own universe.
Right.
Now, you're going outside the solar system and looking for exoplanets.
Right.
But our real limitation is that we can't get to a place and observe ourselves from afar, right?
That's right. It's a major challenge. So we think about what the Earth would look like if we were observing our solar system from a distant star. So it's difficult to even get, you know, to Mars, for example. We know this is a major challenge for NASA, and certainly going to nearby stars, some of which we know now have planets, is a major technological challenge. But we sort of have to think about things in terms of what would our solar system look like from outside in order to quantify what we might be able to detect and understand from here.
Is that something that is sort of in the back of your mind or anything as you go? Because you really are venturing out there. Are there any theories developing for what that picture looks like? I know I've seen sort of a picture of the universe that has been published, and we have this latest infrared or the energy radiation. The
Planck satellite.
Yes, the Planck satellite, which shows us that what the universe is now 13 billion years old, believed
right.
to be.
Yep.
So, you know, we seem to be moving toward that direction, but are you confident that this is even possible at some point?
Well, I think it's going to be a major challenge, and certainly if this is a possibility, the technological avenue will be something we haven't even conceived of yet.
Well, we're again speaking with Dr. Cullen Blake, who is in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Pennsylvania, and you've got so much in this vita of yours, Dr. Blake. But I noticed that in one of the listings here, it says primary research and educational interests, and binary stars and eclipsing binaries is listed there. We didn't talk about those things. What do you mean a binary star?
So the sun, as I mentioned earlier, it's often called an average star. But in fact, about 50% of stars happen to be in pairs or even triples.
Wait a minute. Now we've just gone into Star Wars. Are you talking about Luke Skywalker?
Exactly. Tatooine, right?
That's right.
So the sun is a lone star, but most stars actually have a companion, and these stars orbit each other. And by observing stars that are orbiting each other, we can learn about the physics, the structure, composition of these stars with great precision.
And, I mean, when you look at something like this, you're using the same techniques you've been telling us about.
Exactly. So the same measurement techniques that enable us to study these binary stars can be used, if we improve upon them, to detect planets and characterize planets orbiting other stars.
Yeah, I saw a recent, I guess it was a news story, it was CBS This Morning, and the actor Alan Alda was involved in this particular episode. And right now, in his mid-70s, he's embarked on a career at NYU teaching scientists how to speak clearly and in simple layman's terms what they're doing. And I guess the idea here is, Dr. Blake, that often science has much more to offer us but has a hard time translating it to the general public.
Absolutely. It's a major challenge, and the importance of this, I think, can't be underestimated. I mean, it's critically important for scientists to be able to convey what they do to the public, you know, in part because a lot of what we do is supported directly by the public. And it's also, you know, fundamentally interesting stuff. But I feel like in the field of exoplanets, we have a distinct advantage in this regard because people are sort of excited about exoplanets. And again, it involves concepts that are relatively easy to explain and everyone has an intuition for. They understand a planet. So we have an advantage in that regard. And we try hard, and I think do a good job of advertising results to the general public.
That was Dr. Colin Blake, assistant professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Pennsylvania. He was speaking with the Best of Our Knowledge's science reporter, David Gustina, as part of our astrobiology series on the origins of life. Our coverage is made possible by the NASA Astrobiology Institute through support from the New York Center for Astrobiology, located at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York, in partnership with the University of Albany, the University of Arizona, and Syracuse University. To learn more about all of the topics in our astrobiology series, head to origins.rpi.edu. Back here on Earth, it seems that tropical rainforests have just about all the heat they can handle. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. Climate change is pushing the mercury higher, and more so in the Arctic than in tropical regions of the globe. But as Stephanie Pau, assistant professor of biogeography at Florida State University, explains, when it comes to comparing the Arctic and the tropics, it is more than a matter of degrees.
I study how the growth of tropical forests is impacted by climate change. Tropical forests are incredibly diverse and dynamic, showing rapid and longer-term changes in growth and mortality. At a large spatial scale, the primary limiting factors on plant growth are temperature, rainfall, and light. Tropical forests are generally warm and wet year-round, so their growth and productivity may be most limited by light and cloud cover. On the other hand, tropical forests may be highly sensitive to temperature because they are living closer to their upper temperature tolerance. Recently, I've worked with an international team of scientists, and we investigated the effects of temperature, rainfall, and cloud cover on flower production at two contrasting sites, a seasonally dry and a wet tropical forest. At both these sites, long-term ground observations of flower productivity have been collected, and we combined these data with satellite observations of cloud cover over the past several decades because clouds are one of the largest uncertainties in climate change science. What we found was that whereas clouds have a variable effect at each site and primarily on a seasonal time scale, temperature has been the most consistent effect on flower productivity at both sites. There has been a long-term steady increase in flower productivity at the seasonally dry site, where flower production has increased at about 3% each year on average. This long-term increase appears to be tied to temperature and not clouds. Even though temperature increases are projected to be smaller in the tropics than in high-latitude regions such as tundra or Arctic ecosystems, our work shows that tropical species are sensitive to only small degrees of warming.
That was Stephanie Pau of Florida State University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.